Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. I told you it was going to be a good show today. Right now, we got Jimmy Akin here in the studio with us. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of the brand new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. He's also the man behind the free course with Jimmy Akin on the Bible that you can get at Catholic.com right now. He's a busy man. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
How's it going, Cy?
Very, very well. I just got to meet two of the nicest women I've ever met, two sisters of life
from
Denver. It was
cool.
Very, very nice. Open forum is what we're doing this hour, though. And if you have a question about the Catholic faith, if you have a question about the Bible, we'd be more than welcome to ask because it's kind of Bible month here at Catholic Answers. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. But if your question is of a different nature, maybe you have a more generally religious question, a philosophical question, a question about the sacraments, the popes, it's all welcome.
Mind control parasites.
I didn't listen.
Oh.
I forgot.
But people could ask questions about mind control parasites.
You are welcome. Yes, thank you, Jimmy. Area 51, is that open?
No, you sure.
Okay, or mind control parasites. And the reason I say to Jimmy, I didn't listen when he said that is because he just did an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It came out on Friday. It's about mind control parasites, and I missed it. I mean,
no,
I'm sure it's still available.
It's still, yeah, that's the nice thing about podcasting. You can listen at your convenience.
Again, 888-318-7884, the number. Should I fear mind control?
Not overly much.
No, I just, okay. Just I can go on with my day.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. All right. As I mentioned, Jimmy's book is The Bible is a Catholic Book. Have you been getting response to the book?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's been very positive. I've been doing a bunch of interviews on it, on other people's radio stations and podcasts, and the response has been very, very positive, so that's good to hear.
Very, very good. Yeah, I can imagine so. It's kind of a stereotype of us Catholics that we don't love the Bible, but that really is an unfair stereotype. There's a great deal of love of the Bible.
Oh, yeah. The church loves the Bible so much that it reads it to you at every Mass you go to.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Again, 888-31-TRUTH, the number. A whole bunch of folks already on the lines. As a matter of fact, we're ready to go. Ready to take a question?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Mark in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. You are first up this hour. Mark, your question for Jimmy.
I need to hold off on today's question, or will I be able to get it in?
No, you can ask. Mark, you're live on the air now.
Oh, okay. My question is a while back, someone said we should not limit the number of children that couples can have and limit the refugees coming into our country because we need young people to work and pay taxes so that we can support the elderly. And I'm thinking that those young people will grow themselves to be elderly and will need young people, and that will snowball, the population would snowball until the United States by itself would end up with 1 billion or 2 billion people eventually.
Okay. So your question then, Mark, is about population?
Yeah, and it would continue to snowball in a vicious cycle to where the United States alone would have billions of people.
This argument was proposed actually a few centuries ago by a British clergyman named Malthus. And as a result, he predicted that the population would continue to grow at an exponential rate, and that would be a problem because the resources to sustain that population would only grow at a linear rate. And as a result, eventually the rise in population would outstrip the resources available to sustain the population, and we would have a situation of mass starvation and wars and things like that. And this event that was predicted, it came to be known as the Malthusian crisis, where population outstrips resources. And the thing is, history hasn't borne that out. Even though the world's population has grown, what we've found is that a couple things, but one of the things we found is that not only do we have more mouths coming into the world when a new baby or when new babies are born, we also have more brains coming into the world when new babies are born. And they put those brains to work, among other things, figuring out how they can feed their mouths. And so that has spurred along with population growth, there has been an equal or greater jump in technological progress that has allowed us to produce an abundance of resources. Today, people around the world, now this is an average, I'm not talking about every single person, but people on average today have vastly more resources available to them than at any time in history. That's one of the reasons we have an obesity crisis today, is because food is so plentiful, it's so cheap and so easy to get compared to any historical age of the past, that people have been eating to the point that they've been gaining weight. So rather than the mass starvation that Malthus predicted, we actually have an obesity epidemic. And there's no reason to think that the trend of improving resources is going to suddenly cut off as the population grows. And so we needn't think of the we need not think of a growth in population as leading to a Malthusian crisis. The predictions of one have not been fulfilled historically. Also, we don't have reason to think that trends like population growth are going to continue indefinitely. Malthus predicted that we were going to have geometric population growth, so that after a certain length of time, the population would double. And then after that same period of time, again, it would quadruple. And then after that same period, it would be up to eight times the level. So you have this accelerating curve going into the future. But that's not what's happened. As technology has progressed, people have actually had fewer children because they don't need as many children to sustain them, for example, in their old age. We've also shifted from an agricultural economy where you need lots of children to work on the farm with you to a goods and services economy that's more based in cities. And the process of citification, where people move from the country to the city, has also led to a decreased number of children. And so actually the current world population is leveling off and is expected to not continue to accelerate. And so I don't know who you were listening to before, and I don't know exactly what they said. I would agree that we should not limit the number of children that couples are allowed to have. That would be an imposition on their human rights as parents. But I don't think we need to worry about an uncontrolled upward population spiral in the U.S. Actually, if present trends continue, it's going to level off and then perhaps even start declining like it has in Japan and other highly developed nations.
Mark, thank you for starting us off. I hope that that was helpful to you. 888-318-7884 is the number. And up next is Mike in Madisonville, Louisiana, listening on the mighty 690 AM. Are you there with us, Mike?
I am. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Your question for Jimmy?
Good. Thank you for taking my call. Yes. Going back to the abortion issue, of course, it was said that every life has value, which, of course, I agree with. When Jesus was alluding to Judas Iscariot, and he made the statement that it would have been better that he had never been born, does that indirectly give ammunition to the pro-choice side, saying, look, you know, this guy was terrible. Obviously, other people who have been terrible, they've been aborted too. So, you know, there is something to it. I know that wasn't the meaning of it, but does it indirectly help the other side?
Well, it may help some of them for rhetorical purposes if they try to use that verse to support their case, but it wouldn't actually do so. It wouldn't, in the sense of giving us actual real reasons to support abortion. There are several reasons for that. As you note, that's not what Jesus was saying. Jesus wasn't saying it would have been better if someone had aborted Judas Iscariot. He said it would have been better for Judas if he had not been born, because then he wouldn't go on to commit the crimes for which he's going to have to face judgment. So Judas would have had a benefit if he had not been born, and he might have not been born either by not being conceived, in which case he wouldn't exist at all, or by miscarrying, before he was born. Either one of those would have stopped him from committing the crimes that he freely chose to commit and that he'll have to face judgment for. But simply saying it would be better for a given individual who chooses to commit horrendous crimes not to have been born is not to say that it's okay to murder that person while they're in the womb. And for that matter, the womb is irrelevant. Judas didn't commit any crimes when he was 1 year old, so that argument would also justify infanticide, if it justified anything. Or when Judas was 10, he hadn't betrayed Christ, and so it wouldn't justify killing a 10-year-old child either. So there's no real support here for the idea of deliberately aborting somebody. Jesus was making a statement about what would have been better for Judas personally if, say, he had miscarried before he was born. But that doesn't justify other people in actively killing somebody. And the case of Judas is actually instructive because it reveals how God brings good even out of evil. Even though Judas freely chose to betray Jesus under the influence of the devil, but nevertheless, he freely chose it, God brought about the redemption of the world through that act. And so even when you do have somebody like a Judas or a Hitler or a Stalin or a Mao or a Pol Pot or a Charles Manson, even though they do enter the world and do horrendous things, God will ultimately bring good out of that.
And we'll leave that there, Mike, because we've got to take a break. But I hope that that was helpful to you. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we'll be right back.
Some atheistic scientists claim we don't need God to explain the universe because science is sufficient to get the job done. But is this true? The answer is no, and here's the reason. Science could never negate the need for God because it can't give an exhaustive explanation of the universe. First, it relies on the inductive method in order to validate its hypotheses. As such, scientists can never be certain they've discovered every piece of data necessary to give a complete explanation. They must always be open to discovering something new that could alter their current theory. Furthermore, science presupposes an existing universe to observe and explain. Thus, it could never explain why the universe exists in the first place rather than not. Science has explanatory power, but not enough power to negate the need for God. I'm Carlo Broussard with a Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Why do we need Catholic radio? Because not everybody's sitting in front of a computer or watching their television set at home. How about when driving to work? Catholic radio's there for you. I may be a Catholic priest, but I'm still a student of the faith, and Catholic radio helps supply good material, whether it be a question and answer format show, whether it be a show itself on doctrine or theology. I myself, as a priest, am always learning.
Father Wade thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. 888-318-7884 is our number. And Jimmy was mentioning all the interviews and things he's doing for the book. And we were talking about Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World with the new podcast up on Friday. But he wasn't busy enough, so we sat him down and asked him to tell us about schism, because there's a lot of talk about schism.
Yes,
you told me I can pronounce it anyway, but I can't settle on one. There's a lot of people talking about it. And so you were gracious enough to sit with us and talk about it. About what it means, and about, you made some speculations about what the risks of schism are now.
Yeah, and I don't think they're particularly high.
Yeah, and I was happy to hear that. And but your reasoning I found very, very interesting. But if you want to know all about what does it mean, schism, why are people talking about that, and what are the prospects for it, Catholic Answers Focus is out now. Like, you can go to CatholicAnswersFocus.com and listen to it, or you can go to wherever you subscribe for podcasts and subscribe, and then you'll get it every week. But this week's is a bit of a response to current events with all the talk of schism. You just go to CatholicAnswersFocus.com and you can listen to that interview we got to do with Jimmy. Up next is Jonathan in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Wait a second. Is this the same Jonathan that I accidentally hung up on last hour?
It's not.
Okay. All right. Okay. Good.
I'm a new caller.
All right, Jonathan, your question for Jimmy.
My question relates to to heresy. Mm-hmm. So I am not a Catholic,
mm-hmm.
and so I have and so though we share, I like to try to understand a lot more than I do because we have a shared ecclesiastical history.
Uh-huh.
But according to my worldview, then, just briefly, as after the death of the apostles and the church kind of splintered a little bit, and then one of the splintered denominations was declared to be the main denomination, and all the others were labeled as heretical. And my question is, on whose authority does the church label heresy? So, is it on the basis of comparing to the scriptures? Is it simply comparing to tradition, or is there, like...
Yeah, no, I think, Jonathan, I think we have it, and I think you have the right guy to answer the question. On whose authority?
Well, so the term heresy has had a variety of meanings over the course of time. It's a term that's developed theologically. You won't find it used in Scripture. It's really the way it's used today is it's kind of like the term Bible. You won't find the term Bible in the texts of the biblical books because it's a post-biblical term, but it describes a reality that people had to, that existed in the time of the apostles. And in the same way, heresies existed in the times of the apostles, though that term hadn't been coined for them. Now, during much of church history, the term heresy had a kind of a flexible meaning, but in recent centuries, it's come to refer to something very specific. And so what I'm going to give you is the modern use of the word heresy. In order for someone to be a heretic, they, number one, need to be baptized. So they're someone who's claiming I'm a Christian. And number two, they need to refuse to accept what's called a dogma. A dogma is something that the church, by the divine authority given to it by Jesus Christ, has said, this is divinely revealed. This is infallibly true. God has revealed this fact to us. And so if you refuse to accept a dogma and you're baptized and you refuse to accept the dogma obstinately, not because you're innocently unaware or you were raised in a different tradition or something like that, then that would be heresy today. And so, for example, Jonathan, since you're not Catholic, I assume you weren't raised Catholic, you would not be considered a heretic because the church wouldn't say that you were in bad faith. You were just raised in a different tradition where people have different beliefs about something. And so even if you don't accept all of the dogmas of the that the church teaches, you wouldn't be regarded as a heretic. The church today would use language and say, well, you're a brother in Christ, but you're a separated brother because we don't share all of the same beliefs. So that would deal with how the situation is described today. In terms of where does the authority come from to say that a position is heretical, that's something that is implied by the power of the keys that Christ gave his church. He does this initially for St. Peter in Matthew 16, and then he later shares it with the other apostles in Matthew 18. And so he gave to the leaders of the church this power of the keys. And we need to say, okay, so what does that mean? Well, this is a phrase that doesn't mean a lot in our culture, the power to bind and loose, but those terms did have a technical meaning in Judaism at the time. We know this not only because they were used in the New Testament, but also because they're used in various ancient Jewish authors like the Jewish historian Josephus, who lived in the first century, and also by various rabbinical sources in rabbinical Judaism. And basically, the power to bind and loose represented the ability to, one of its meanings was the ability to make binding laws for the community of faith. And Josephus, for example, talks about how during a certain period in Israel's history, the Pharisees had the power to bind and loose, to make authoritative rules for the Jewish community. And so Jesus shared that power with the apostles. Well, one of the things that Jesus talked about in this very same context in Matthew 18 is that if someone doesn't listen even to the church, then treat him like a Gentile or a tax collector, namely an outsider. So Jesus envisioned the possibility, if someone commits certain offenses, of excluding that person from the Christian community or excommunicating them. And one of the offenses that can justify that is denying a doctrine that is known to have been revealed by God. So, for example, if somebody said, well, I don't believe God even exists. Well, God has revealed that he exists. Or if someone said, I don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. Well, God has revealed that Jesus is the Messiah. And so if you're denying, if you're flat out denying something that God has revealed in that way, then you're not in agreement with the Christian faith. You're not in agreement with what God has revealed. And so for your good and the good of the community, you need to be removed from it to hopefully wake you up to the fact that what you're doing is wrong and you need to embrace the Christian faith. So that's why Jesus gave the leaders of his church the power to bind and loose and thus to include or exclude people from the Christian community. And that's kind of a snapshot. I go into a lot more detail about this in a book I wrote called Teaching with Authority, but I hope that gives you at least a kind of starting sketch. And you're welcome to call in the future and ask follow-up questions. We'll be more than happy to help in any way we can.
Thanks, Jonathan. 888-31-TRUTH, our number here. It is open forum. Let's go to Abby in Cary, North Carolina, listening on the iCatholic Radio app. Abby, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. I really appreciate you guys and everything you do. I'm coming back to the church after about 25 years of not practicing.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't really know how to get myself together and get prepared to go back to confession.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know if you guys had any tips or resources.
The basic thing that I would recommend is getting what's called an examination of conscience. These are documents that review sins that people sometimes commit. And I would say, and there are a bunch that are online that you can get for free. I would say, and I believe EWTN has an examination of conscience in their library, so you might want to check at EWTN.com. But get an examination of conscience and take your time. Go over it and, you know, do your best to think of, have I done these different things? And if you have, you know, make a note of them, at least mentally. If you can't remember if you did something, then don't worry about it. God understands the sacrament will be valid as long as you don't deliberately withhold something that you know for a fact you need to confess. If you've forgotten a sin, God understands that. Our memories aren't perfect. And so you'll still be forgiven.
Okay, Abby?
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you. And God bless you in your journey.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. We'll go to Andrew in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Andrew, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I love the show, so I was kind of happy when I stumbled upon something that I thought might be good to call in about. A couple of weeks ago, I read an article in the news that said the priest in charge of a Catholic school down in Nashville, they pulled all the Harry Potter books off the shelves at the school. And the reasoning that he gave for this in a letter that he wrote, I'm going to read from the article here. He said, "These books present magic as both good and evil, which is not true. The curses and spells used in the books are actual curses and spells, which when read by a human being, risk conjuring evil spirits into the presence of the person reading the text." And it goes on to say that he did consult with both exorcists and the Catechism of the Catholic Church before he made this decision. I had never heard this before. I thought mm-hmm. it was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I was just hoping that, I don't know if this is anything that you've heard before.
Oh, yeah.
give me some insight into that.
All right, Andrew, okay. Thanks. Glad you found something to call about, Andrew. It's so, nice to get your call.
So I would say that, just to lay my cards on the table up front, I'm not personally a fan of the Harry Potter books. I don't think they're well written. but that's a matter of taste, and so I don't expect everybody to agree with that. I have read the first Harry Potter book, and I did so precisely because people were making comments like this about it, and I needed to inform myself, does this have real spells in it and so forth. I would also say the church doesn't expect magic to always be depicted as evil. There can be fantasy things where magic is used, like Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, or some of the things you read in C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. So just the fact that magic is presented as both good and bad in a work of fantasy isn't a problem. But I'll have more to say on the other side of the break.
Hang on, Andrew. Thanks for the question. It is open forum, 888-318-7884. We'll finish our discussion of Harry Potter on the other side.
Hello, this is Bishop Jeffrey Monfort and Bishop of the Diocese of Steubenville. Make sure you keep it on Catholic Answers Live. God bless you.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
After Jesus, who do you believe has most influenced the world?
Share with us on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now, let's return to more of Catholic Answers Live.
The music.
There it is. Nick, you're a genius. It's Thursday. You remembered. You played the groovy music. Thank you so much, Nick. Really like your drumming on that.
Yeah.
888-318-7884 is the number here. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin's our guest. We just heard the groovy music, so I get to be mellow now for the rest of the hour. And Andrew's on the line from Omaha, Nebraska, asking about Harry Potter. Is there a problem with the books, and are the spells in there
real?
Are they real?
Okay.
So you were in the midst of answering that.
Yeah. So like I said before, I'm not a fan of the Harry Potter books. I read the first one in particular. I've seen more than that of the movies, but I don't think they're particularly well written.
There's no Nancy Drew, that's for sure.
Or Hardy Boys.
Yeah.
But that's just my opinion. That's a matter of taste. Other people like them. Obviously, a lot of people like them, or they wouldn't be as successful as they are.
Right.
In terms of the magic in them, one of the things that Andrew cited from this article he was reading was a priest said that they portray magic as both being able to be used for good and bad, and that that is not okay in the priest's opinion. Well, that may be the priest's opinion, but that hasn't historically been the judgment of Catholic moral theologians. This is a work of fantasy, and you can imagine in a work of fantasy that God has set up the universe differently than our universe. Now, in our universe, we're not supposed to use magic, but in a different universe that God has set up differently, it matters can be different. And so the church historically has been open to works of fantasy like, and just to cite two recent examples that people will be familiar with, but there are others going all the way back, like Lord of the Rings or the Chronicles of Narnia, which have both good and bad magic in them. So I wouldn't say that that all depictions of magic as anything other than evil are in a work of fantasy are a problem. In terms of the spells in Harry Potter, well, when the first Harry Potter movie came out, that was when I read the book, and I was reading, you know, I read all the different chapters, and it had some spells in it. And they're typically like little two-word phrases or something like that. They're not like big rituals.
Right.
Well, it so happened I was filling in as a tutor in a Latin class at that time. And I took one of the spells from Harry Potter. I think it was for fixing eyeglasses. And I think it was something like Oculus Reparato. And I said to the students in the class, parse this for me. Tell me, you know, decline this noun and conjugate this verb and so forth. Tell me the Latin forms that it's using. And they thought about it, and they couldn't. And I said, not only is this not real magic, it's not even real Latin. It was just phony pseudo-Latin. Mm-hmm. So the spells, based on my experience in Harry Potter, are not real spells. They're not even real Latin. They're just made to sound kind of Latin-y. And so I would say that, unless there are spells that I am unaware of, the priest was misinformed on this. Having said that, if he wants to take the books out of his school library, I don't have a problem with that. That's a prudential call. I also, every school needs to be responsive to its own community and to what the parents want and things like that. So I wouldn't say, oh, horrors, he's not carrying Harry Potter in his library. I don't mind if he doesn't carry Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that the grounds that you cited for his removing them were ones that I would say warrant the removal.
So, Andrew, how's that?
That sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming up with a good question and calling. We're happy to have you here. 888-318-7884. The number, Jim in Lebanon, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app is next. Jim, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, first of all, so let me say I really enjoy your hosting style, and I have read your book, Ad Limitem, and I really enjoyed it. So
that's very nice of you to say that. Thank you.
Well, you know, we're not going to comment on my the sophistication of my literary palate, though, shall we? Jimmy, the question I have for you is, I know you're interested in shows like Doctor Who and Star Trek, things like that.
Sure.
And I'm just curious, like, I stopped watching those shows when I started seeing very, anti-Catholic type of or immoral type of messages and stuff being in them.
Mm-hmm.
So questions like the things like the streaming services, especially some that are coming up online here soon. Knowing the companies and their stances towards various social topics and stuff, at what point in time are we, if we want to subscribe, are we materially participating in advocating for their stances and stuff like that? Does that make sense?
We're materially participating in other people's actions anytime we give them any support. If you buy a pizza from a pizza place, you're materially contributing to the funding of that pizza place, and they're going to pay their employees, and so you are materially participating in what the employees choose to do with that money. But every pizza place, just like every other business, has employees who are sinners, and they're going to do some things either at the corporate level right there at the pizza office, or the private employees, once they get paid, are going to take some of that money and do something with it they shouldn't. So the church does not expect us not to materially cooperate with the actions of others, even if they're sinful. What the church does expect us to do is not to formally cooperate with them, which means not approving of what they do, and it expects us not to cooperate in a very close way with or in a very significant way with what they're doing that's bad. The language that gets used in Catholic moral theology for this is our cooperation with others, even when they're doing something evil, needs to be remote and material. And so if you're contributing money to a business, then unless the evil activity makes up a very substantial part of what that business does, and you could argue, say, in the case of Planned Parenthood, it does. But unless what they're doing that's evil is a very big part of what they're doing, then the cooperation is going to end up being remote. And if you don't approve of it, it's also going to be material. And so if it's both remote and material and you're otherwise deriving a benefit from it, then it's morally justifiable. So, for example, in the pizza case, well, maybe the pizza owner is going to give, you know, out of all the money they rake in that year, maybe he's going to give $100 to support abortion. But out of thousands and thousands of dollars that the pizza place takes in, that's a very small amount. So, and so the any degree of cooperation you had is very small. In the same way with companies that make media, well, if it's a service that makes porn, a lot of its activity is going to be evil. And so it's going to be very hard to support that because the cooperation won't simply be remote and material. On the other hand, if it's Disney, most of what they do, even if it's not inspired by a Christian worldview, most of what they do is not a direct assault on the Christian faith. There may be some programs that they make that have morally problematic content, but it's not the bulk of what they do. And so in that situation, there wouldn't be a requirement of not supporting them or not paying for their service. One could choose to say, even if I'm not required to refrain from supporting them, I'm still going to refrain from supporting them because I don't like their social agenda. In other words, I'm going to boycott them. But if you're my advice to anybody who it wants to boycott somebody is if you're going to boycott them, tell them why. Because if you don't tell them why you're boycotting them, they don't have the information they need to reevaluate their behavior. So I always say, if you want to boycott somebody, tell them why you're boycotting. Don't hide that information from them, because then they don't know why you're not a customer and what they would need to do to make you a customer. Also, I would say we don't want to be overly scrupulous about this. As Paul talks about in his letters, God doesn't call us to not live in the world. We're going to have to interact with people who have different views and who are not Christian and who are even anti-Christian. We're going to have to interact with those people in this world. We shouldn't be puritanical about, I'm going to have no involvement with other people. In fact, St. Paul said that, you know, let's say you're in the ancient world and you go to the meat market and all the meat there has been offered to idols. So you're if you buy meat, it's going to be from a person who used that meat to worship Zeus.
Yeah.
And Paul says, you can eat the meat as long as you're not approving of the worship of Zeus and you're not leading other people into sin. You can eat that meat because it really an idol is nothing. There's no real Zeus like yeah. that. So Paul was not puritanical about this. Paul himself read Greek works and works of Greek pagan literature. And we know that because he quotes them. He's both depicted as quoting them in the book of Acts, and he quotes them in his own letters. And so he was familiar with Greek literature, even pagan Greek literature. And that meant he had to pay for it, to buy it and read it. And he didn't have a problem with that. So I would say, even though it can be very tempting to say, I'm just going to have nothing to do with anything that's contrary to the Christian faith, that's actually not the attitude that we see being taken. It's the kind of isolationist attitude that would actually cause us to have to withdraw from engaging in culture, and that's going to hinder our efforts to evangelize the culture.
Jim, thank you very, very much for that. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. The number is 888-318-7884. I feel like the hour is just zipping by. Carrie told me today that you have an article in the upcoming edition of Catholic Answers Magazine on the Magi.
Yes. Uh-huh.
On the mystery of the Magi?
Yeah.
Want to share?
So when Jesus was born, there were these magi, and they came from the east, and I talk about who they are in this article.
We always pronounce things differently. I say magi, you say magi. Mm-hmm. I say schism, you say schism.
Mm-hmm.
I say tomato.
Tomato.
that's in the Christmas or the November-December
issue.
Okay, so I think Carrie told me that because he wants me to say this. You can get the November-December issue by subscribing now to Catholic Answers Magazine. Just go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com and subscribe, and then you'll know about the mysteries of the Magi. CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I would describe myself as a revert, and ever since I came back to a practice of my faith, I started praying the rosary, going to even daily mass, God has led me on an amazing journey and used me in a lot of incredible ways that I never dreamed would have been possible, and I'm just so grateful to God for all of his gifts and blessings in my life.
Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, tomorrow, noon Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Open forum. Lots of people on the line, so I'll just keep going to the calls. Next up is Eric in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Eric, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Si. I was talking to a Protestant friend of mine, and he was contrary to the ministerial priesthood, as is practiced in the church. And he, you know, sola scriptura is his thing. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to defend the ministerial priesthood, I might as well play from his, you know, his tool bag.
Uh-huh.
So how would you go about defending the ministerial priesthood as we have it, using, you know, the Bible to their satisfaction?
Well, I would need to know, what I would want to know is what's his objection to it? Because depending on who you're talking to, coming from a Protestant perspective, they may have one or another objection, and I would want to understand his objection. One of the most common objections that you'll hear is that in the Old Testament, you had a high priest, and then you had the ministerial priesthood that served as at the temple. But in the New Testament, we have Jesus as our high priest, and then it says we're all, as Christians, priests. So we have this common priesthood instead of the ministerial priesthood. And actually, that's an incomplete presentation of the data. It's sort of cherry-picking the data. There are verses in the New Testament that talk about all Christians as being a royal priesthood. So there is a priesthood of all believers. But, you know, those passages in the New Testament that say that, they're actually quotations from the Old Testament. And you go back and you look at the original passages in the Old Testament, and they're applying this to all of the people of Israel. So really what you had in ancient Israel was a high priest at the top, a ministerial priesthood under him, and then a common priesthood of all Israelites. below that. And so if you take, so it's kind of like a pyramid structure of priesthood. And if you take that and you say, okay, well, how does that correspond to today? Well, we know we've got the common priesthood because it applies it to all Christians in the New Testament. We know we have Jesus as our high priest. Hebrews says that. And so that would lead us to suspect that there's going to be a ministerial priesthood in the New Testament as well. So do we find evidence of that? Well, yeah, we do. If you read Romans, this is like Romans chapter 15, Paul talks about how as a minister of the gospel, he has the priestly duty of offering to God the Gentiles. And so Paul envisions his ministry as a Christian minister as involving priestly functions. And so we have evidence right there of a ministerial priesthood in the New Testament. And there are, you know, further questions one can ask about all this and how it works, but we do see evidence of a threefold structure for the priesthood in the New Testament, including a ministerial priesthood, just like we had the same thing in the Old Testament.
Eric, I hope that was helpful to you. We will leave it there and continue to try to...
I do want to mention, I did a debate actually on this a number of years ago with a former priest named Anthony Pizzotta.
Okay.
It's called the Priesthood Debate. I have notes for it on my website, jimmyakin.com, but also I think we may sell it at shop.catholic.com.
The debate itself.
The debate itself.
Okay.
Interesting, good news. Anthony Pizzotta, before he died, became a Catholic again.
Oh, praise God.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. All right, let's go to Paul in Indianapolis. Indiana, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio, channel 130. Paul, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a lifelong Catholic, cradle Catholic, and I was talking with a friend who was raised Lutheran, and he was saying that his problem with the Catholic Church is the Pope claims to be the right hand of God. And I have never heard the Pope claim that, and I was just wondering if there's any scripture-based if that's even been put out there or discussed in by the Pope. Or
so did he claim this Pope has said that, Pope Francis, or just some Pope has said that?
No, I don't believe that. I didn't really get into it.
Okay.
As far as his I was just surprised, and then we just kind of... we don't talk religion and politics too often.
So what I would say, and I actually have a section on this in my book, Teaching with Authority, you frequently will encounter claims on what I call the papal rumor net. Because there's lots of unreliable claims out there about what a given pope, either present or past, has said. And I recommend asking a series of questions whenever someone comes up with a claim, because anytime somebody claims something to you and wants you to buy their claim, the burden of proof is on them to show it. You know, if you tell me what you believe, well, that's fine. That may be what you believe, but I don't have to accept it unless you give me some evidence for it. And so if someone says the Pope claims to be the right hand of God, I'm going to immediately have some questions about that. The first one is, what do you mean? Did he really say that, or is that your paraphrase? And what if it's your paraphrase, what do you mean by that? Help me understand what you mean by that phrase. On the other hand, if he says, no, the Pope actually said that, that's a quotation of the Pope, I would say, okay, what's your source on that? Because we need to look at the source and see, does it exist? Is it reliable? If a Pope said that, what did it mean in context? And if someone wants you to believe the Pope has said this, then they need to be able to say, okay, well, here's what my source is. I did a quick check before you got on the air, and I was able to find nothing on this Pope saying he is the right hand of God. I found lots of things where a Pope will say Jesus is sitting at the right hand of God, but that's not the same thing as I am the right hand of God. It's certainly not a matter of Catholic teaching that the Pope is the right hand of God. That's not something you're going to find, for example, in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I am aware that there are various quotations attributed to popes in the past that when you check them out, are very hard to verify or even false. But even if they were something that some popes sometimes said, that doesn't make it church teaching. So I would say there's a whole bunch of uncertainties here. And if your friend wants you to take his claim seriously, then your friend needs to give you some evidence for it. And my first two questions would be, what do you mean by that? Is that literally what a pope said? Or if it's not, what do you mean by it? And if it is something you think a pope said, what's your source for that? Let's track that down together and find out what the truth is.
Paul, thanks very much. I hope that was helpful. Jason in Nashville, Tennessee is next, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Jason, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Sure, Jimmy. The kind of question I had was about the Archdiocese of the U.S. military. I guess apart from its size, mm-hmm. the military, that is, why have the creation of an archdiocese or a diocese?
Nope.
And obviously, my knowledge base might be.
You know what? You're coming in and out a little bit. So
I guess, got the sense of the question.
Okay.
The reason that the church has established an archdiocese for the U.S. military, and they have parallel structures for the militaries of other countries, but the reason why is soldiers and their families need pastoral care. They need access to the sacraments. They need spiritual counseling, spiritual direction. They need a normal parish life. And that needs to happen for military men who are living either on military bases or who are forward deployed. It also needs to happen for their families, particularly if their family is living on base with them. So they need to have those functions provided for them, just like the civilian population does. But because of the way the military works, it tends to have, restricted bases that are, separate from the local community. You've got guys on ships. You've got guys in remote places in the world. And there needs to be a way of providing adequate spiritual pastoral care for those people. And so that's why the church has a military archdiocese here in the U.S. and others elsewhere.
Jason, thanks very, very much for the call. Sorry we weren't able to get a very good connection there, but I think we got the question. Mark in Bloomington, Indiana, you are next. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding priestly celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the reasoning for having a celibate priesthood, and I keep hearing that many priests coming out affirming the need for a celibate priesthood, especially with the Synod on the Amazon coming up. But my question is, I seem to see somewhat of an inconsistency in the church, because I also know someone who is married and has 5 kids, and because he used to be a Methodist minister, the bishop decided, oh, well, since you used to be a Methodist pastor, you can become ordained to be a priest, even though you're married and have 5 kids.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just wondering why there's this kind of inconsistency. Like, yes, celibacy is so important, but yet we're going to go ahead and ordain someone who has 5 kids already just because he used to be a Methodist pastor.
Sure. So the requirement of celibacy in the Latin Rite of the Church is not a matter of divine law. That's been understood, from way back. That's why, for example, in Eastern Catholic churches, many of them don't have a celibate priesthood. They will ordain married men to the priesthood. And so this isn't a matter of divine law. There are reasons for celibacy in the priesthood. Many people would argue that it's important that we maintain it as a discipline for a whole bunch of different reasons. But it's never been understood as this is an absolute requirement. And so since it's not an absolute requirement, since it's not something, maybe a very good thing, but since it's not something God demands by the nature of the sacrament, it is something where prudence has to be exercised. And the church needs to look at different situations and say, okay, what's the prudent thing to do here? Even if it makes a general judgment that in the Latin Rite, it's a good thing and the best thing to have priests be celibate in general, that doesn't mean there aren't exceptions to that, where it would be better to make an exception in a particular case. And so in the case of various Eastern rites, the church has looked at those situations and said, here it makes sense to ordain married men to the priesthood. And in the case of at least a few people in the Latin Rite, like people who have been ministers in other denominations who become Catholic, the church has looked at those situations and in recent decades said it can make sense in this man's case to go ahead and ordain him even though he's married. And so while celibacy in the priesthood is a good thing and there are good reasons for it, it doesn't mean it's a universal that has to apply in all times and places in the Catholic Church. And it's meant to be a general rule, but not an exceptionalist rule.
Okay, Mark.
Oh, kind of. I'm still kind of fuzzy on it because I understand the difference of, like, it's not dogma, it's, you know, discipline, not doctrine sort of thing. But I just don't, why would some married men get a pass and some not?
Because they had formerly been ministers. They had already adapted themselves and their families to a life of ministry towards others. And thus, if anybody was going to be, it also facilitates their reconciliation with the church. If anybody was going to be given an exception, people who are already ministers would be plausible candidates.
Mark, thank you very much for the call. Thanks, everybody, for the call. Sorry to the caller we weren't able to get to. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for another fine hour.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, and on apparently a very good reception it's getting.
Yeah.
You can get Jimmy's book, Amazon, your local Catholic bookstore, shop.catholic.com, in other words, anywhere good Catholic books are sold. And it's one of those books that you can get a deal on at shop.catholic.com if you want to get it in bulk and give it away. Go check that out. We'll see you tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.